I had a dilemma this week because a very dearly respected friend told me not long ago that she preferred I not do sermons by request. She softened the blow by saying she liked my own choices better. But this morning I have a sermon by request. So she's present. I will not reveal her identity. Take a deep breath, good friend. We'll get through it together. When what are widely believed to have been Islamic fundamentalists bombed the American military hotel recently, some of us thought instantly of two charter members of this church, Max and Nancy Amos, who have visited their son and his family in Saudi Arabia. When I called them, Max and Nancy had good news. Their loved ones were close enough to hear and feel the blast, but they were not hurt. Our conversation reminded me that Max had given me some time ago a little booklet he brought back from Saudi Arabia called Islam and Christianity. The book ridicules Christianity, boasts of the superiority of Islam, and is obviously written to win converts. It's such a strange mix of sense and nonsense, truth and falsehood, that I thought it might be instructive to share bits and pieces of it this morning. But before we do, let's take a capsule refresher course in the religion taught by Muhammad some 6 centuries after Christ. Muhammad believed himself to be a prophet sent to turn heathen Arabs to the worship of Allah, the one true God. Those who accepted his message were called Muslims or Muslims, from an Arabic word meaning those who submit to God. The word Islam also means submission. Muslims object to being called Mohammedans because they feel that that word gives the incorrect impression that they worship Muhammad. But it does seem at times to Westerners that their veneration of the prophet approaches worship. The friends of the prophet first wrote down his teachings on any material they could find, and later they combined these writings to form the holy book of the Muslims called the Quran. Parts of the Quran very much resemble the Bible, with stories about characters from the Old Testament and stories from the New about Jesus, who is considered an earlier prophet of God, while Muhammad is the last of the prophets. Youngest of all the great religions, Islam, in many ways, is the simplest and the most explicit. Unlike Hinduism and Buddhism, which evolved slowly, Islam came into being in the full light of history and spread with amazing speed. Within a few years of Muhammad's death in 632 AD, it had overwhelmed the entire Middle East, and within a century, it had spread from Gibraltar all the way to the Himalayas, a huge empire. If it had not been for Charles Martel's military victories over the invading Muslims near the middle of the 8th century, the entire Western world today might be Muslim. Even now, the faith known as Islam is embraced by about 1/7 of the earth's total population. The ethical code of the Quran is stringent. Lying, stealing, illicit sex, murder, gambling, alcohol, eating pork, all are strictly forbidden. Punishment is based on the Old Testament law of retaliation, an eye for an eye. If you murder, you die. The Saudis, as you know, beheaded 4 terrorists just a little more than a month ago, and if they catch up with the most recent bombers, you can expect the same. Polygamy is seen as superior to men's having mistresses, and so Muslim males are permitted to marry up to 4 wives, but the Quran insists that they all be treated kindly. Honor for parents, protection for widows and orphans, charity to the poor, these are only a few of the high standards of conduct demanded by the Prophet. The Quran's descriptions of heaven and hell are vivid. Hell is a place of molten metal, boiling liquids, and fire, where the punishments are adjusted to fit one's sins. Some Muslims do not take it literally, just as many Christians view the hell of their scriptures as figurative rather than literal. Muhammad's heaven is much more interesting. A huge garden with deep rivers, crystal water, lush fruit, and beautiful mansions. The lucky ones who go there eat well and get to drink the wine that was forbidden to them on earth. If you have ever been wearied by too much talk, a risky remark for me to make at this moment, you may appreciate the Quran's promise that, quote, by the mercy of Allah, no speeches are allowed in heaven, not even at banquets. This paradise is guaranteed for suicide bombers and those who die in war, and it is filled with unimaginably beautiful young women, fervently eager to bless faithful Islamic men, each of whom will be assigned 72 of these huris through all eternity, an incentive which helps to explain why so many young men are willing to become suicide bombers when life on earth is drab and hopeless. If you're interested, the Arabic word huri, H-O-U-R-I, literally means black-eyed like a gazelle. Great, lovely, dark-eyed girls. Remember, a woman's eyes are the standard of beauty when form and face are totally covered. The Quran is not quite as long as our New Testament, but not many Westerners find it easy reading. Thomas Carlyle, whose own prose style is so difficult, it used to drive my Victorian lit students to despair, considered the Quran to be, quote, as toilsome reading as I ever undertook, a wearisome, confused jumble. Nothing but a sense of duty, Carlyle says, could carry any European through the Quran. It's probably wise, by the way, to say such things from a safe distance. Muslims consider the Quran a miracle of language and religion, and they reject criticism of it as vehemently as a good Southern Baptist rejects criticism of his holy book. It is unfortunate for the Islamic world that we judge their religion by fanatics and militants who are willing to murder innocent men, women, and children to make their faith prevail. In fairness, Christians must remember to ask themselves how well their own faith comes off when it's judged only by the horrors of the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the burning of thousands of witches, and the violence of militant anti-abortion groups in the name of their religion. Judge Islam by the lives of its finest, as you wish Christianity to be judged, and it comes off quite well. The five pillars of Islamic faith certainly make as much sense as some of the elements of our own religion. One is their creedal statement: there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Another is prayer, ideally meant to be practiced 5 times a day. The closest thing to formal worship is the Friday prayer at noon, when it can be impressive to see in a dimly lighted mosque hundreds of men standing shoulder to shoulder and then kneeling and bending forward until their faces are on the ground. A third pillar is charity. Muhammad imposed a graduated tax on the rich to help the poor, a kind of welfare state sanctioned by religion. The poor tax was expected to amount to 1/40th of one's wealth. Observance of the month-long fast of Ramadan is the fourth pillar, when from daybreak to sunset, no food or drink is to be consumed, and the faithful are to pray and meditate. When it gets dark enough each day so that one cannot distinguish a white thread from a black one, the faithful can begin to partake moderately of food and drink. In practice, many Muslims use much of the daylight hours to make up for lost sleep. And finally, every Muslim is expected to take at least one pilgrimage to the holy city of Mecca, where they unite with the faithful from other countries. Pilgrims take off clothing that might show their status and put on seamless sheets to symbolize that all are the same in the holy city. The Quran preaches that every Muslim is a brother to every other Muslim. And that idea often worked miracles in the quarreling Arab world. Since one of Muhammad's wives was black, and he gave his daughter in marriage to a black, Islam's opposition to racism has made it extremely popular among non-Caucasians. Millions of Africans have embraced the faith, and thousands of black Americans in this country have converted and taken Arabic names. Among the most famous examples are Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali, and Lou Alcindor, who became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The The prophet himself spoke against conversion by force. Let there be no compulsion in religion, he said. Will you force people to believe when belief can come only from God? But theory is one thing and practice is another. And any Christian who has read deeply in the long history of the Crusades must not blame all Muslims for the atrocities of militant fundamentalists who use terror to try to create Islamic states. Some of you, Max and Nancy, I feel quite sure, have heard the muezzin call the faithful to prayer from a minaret, or sometimes now from a radio tower. Muhammad himself was very sensitive to sound, and he disliked bells. So the muezzin sings out in rhythmically Arabic language these words: God is most great, God is most great, Allah Akbar. I testify that there is no God but Allah. I testify that Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. Arise and pray. Arise and pray. God is great. There is no God but Allah. It can be hypnotic. Islam penetrates the whole of life, from birth to death, far more than Christianity usually does. I have a hunch it is often forgotten, but the faithful are even supposed to invoke the name of Allah before sex. And when a baby is born, they are to whisper in its ear the call to prayer. At a funeral, a loved one may whisper questions in the ear of the dead and then give answers for the one who cannot speak. Who is thy God? Allah. What is thy religion? Islam. Who is its prophet? Muhammad. All ways of reminding the dear departed of the proper response to make when angels interrogate him or her in the grave. If you have wondered why Jerusalem, holy to both Jews and Christians, is also holy to Muslims, the answer is that Muhammad visited Jerusalem and its sacred Dome of the Rock, from which he had a vision of a visit to heaven. And now to the booklet Max shared with me. It was written by one who calls himself Dr. Muhammad Ali Akuli, but since I will have to refer to him several times, I'm going to call him Ali for short. I found his booklet fascinating in its mix of truth, half-truth, and a few bizarre falsehoods. He enjoys pointing out, first of all, that Christianity uses four different gospels, which often contradict one another, and that the Old Testament and the New Testament disagree on some very major doctrines like the nature of God and whether there is an afterlife. This is offensive to Christian fundamentalists, but the truth is, he is right. What he fails to mention is that the books of the Bible were written over a period of 1,000 years by many different authors, while by comparison, the Quran was assembled quickly from the teachings of one man. One would expect greater consistency. Christians who read the Bible with great literalness and who are convinced it cannot have a single contradiction or error in it would have a hard time in a debate with Ali. He repeatedly points out contradictions in the Bible, and as every Christian scholar knows, they are present. He says that these same scholars admit that the Bible has between 30,000 and 50,000 mostly very trivial mistakes in dates, science, geography, and history. Whereas, he boasts, Muslim scholars say that their book, the Quran, has not a single mistake. Well, of course, if claiming infallibility for a book makes it infallible, Ali needs to remember that thousands of fundamentalist Christian ministers make the same claim for their sacred book. Ali points out that according to Christianity, Jesus prayed to be delivered from death, but was humiliated, beaten, and crucified. Islam, on the other hand, teaches that God heard the prayer and saved Jesus from the horror of crucifixion. Which is more honorable to God and Jesus, Ali asks, the Christian story or the Islamic story? As for the heavy emphasis on miracles in many pulpits, Ali says that what matters is not the miracles Jesus may have performed, but the teachings he left. And I agree with him. We need to hear more about the ethics of daily life than about the feeding of the 5,000 or the walk on water. No one has to tell us how bitterly the radical Muslims hate America and how we are, for them, the great Satan. But the list of reasons for that feeling may be even longer than you know. In addition to the hatred we create simply by being rich and powerful, the hatred occasioned by envy, we nuked Japan, Ali points out. We helped the Jews occupy Palestine. We are forever interfering with third world countries. And we have infected the whole world, he says, with greed, violence, and immorality. Here are some of the specifics which are constantly fed to Islamic fundamentalists. And I am quoting, sexual liberty started in the Christian West, in Europe and America. Very strange judgment, but he makes it. No control on fornication, no punishment for adultery, boys and girls practicing sex before marriage. Homosexuality has clubs and defenders, women naked everywhere, clubs for the nude, all sorts of sexual abnormalities, prostitution becoming legal, disgustive, I'm not sure that's a word, but his English may not have been acute, unimaginable sexual mania, all that and more, he says, with no word of protest from the church. That comes as a surprise, I think. And that paragraph exhibits the mix I mentioned earlier, some truth, some falsehood, hysterical hyperbole in every other line. According to this propaganda booklet, the family began to fall apart in the Christian West. Husbands with no control over their wives. Parents with no control over their children. Divorce at the drop of a hat. People selling children. Rape, incest, drugs, alcoholism, and for good measure, the guilt of starting two world wars in less than 25 years that killed over 70 million people. He isn't blaming just Americans for that, you must understand, but Europeans, European Christians. Ali says he feels sorry, quote, for people living in the West. Their media, their schools, their streets, and the general pattern of their life is godless. Muslims are not angels, he admits, but their sins cannot even hold a candle to the sins of the West, where, among other things, according to him, AIDS began. I had thought it began in Africa, but Dr. Ali gives us the credit. I prefer not to end on a negative note, even with this bizarre pamphlet. Dr. Ali simply lumps all Christian theology together in order to make all of us look as bad as possible. But many of us would agree with him when he scoffs at the idea of original sin and says, you do not inherit sin, you do not pass it on, you are responsible for your own mistakes. He is strangely misinformed when he accuses Christians of drinking wine as an act of worship, whereas Islam prohibits all use of alcohol. Well, of course, as you know, it is a rare church that uses actual wine in communion in the place of grape juice. But he does touch a vulnerable nerve in our history when he points out that for centuries, the Christian church would not allow ordinary people to read the Bible, reserving that privilege for clergy. In contrast, he says, Islam makes reading the Quran an act of worship, and all Muslims are encouraged to read it constantly. I've talked about these things because Islamic radicals who blow up airplanes and buses and apartment buildings enrage us so much that we tend to forget the multiplied millions of Muslims who lead quiet and decent lives in obedience to the highest principles of their faith. I do not wish my faith to be judged only by medieval Christian crusaders, Salem witch hunters, con men who preach on television, or by any of those people in Massachusetts, Florida, or Wichita, Kansas, who in the name of God killed or tried to kill other Christians for having a different understanding of the Bible. Muslim, Jew, Christian, Buddhist, Hindu, every one of the world's great religions has created millions of noble lives, and sadly, everyone has been betrayed by fanatics. If we fail to remember that, we misjudge all of them. We have enough blind pride in our own traditions and more than enough hatred for those of others. So the plea this morning is for understanding.